Instrument Flight Training, why real clouds will always be a better place to do it than under the hood. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves and of Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated in the Buffalo, New York area. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Paul, as always.
Bob, one of the things you wrote about in the May edition was the dangers involved in simulated instrument training. Now, we've talked about this before, but I never saw you really pull it together in one article. Tell us why you think simulated instrument training is so dangerous for students.
Well, let's start by on a positive note to suggest that simulated instrument training has a tremendous value for certain portions of the overall flight training program. Teaching procedures, using flight simulators to teach instrument procedures and how to enter and navigate through a holding pattern. This is an excellent use of simulated conditions, either in a flight simulator or a view-limiting device. We can go out, and I do this regularly on a sunny day, and we can practice holds and, as I said, and practice some procedures. But when the entire instrument curriculum is built around simulated conditions, we leave the student with the understanding that that simulated conditions are really the same as actual conditions. And clearly, anybody who has been trained in a simulated, almost a totally simulated environment, we put them in the clouds for the first time, the effect is so overwhelming as to cause almost an immediate disorientation. And I wrote in that particular article a tragic accident that happened with a Cessna 182 pilot, three passengers on board down near North Carolina not too long ago. And basically what the pilot had done was gotten himself into instrument conditions. And reading the NTSB transcript, you can see that the pilot himself was admittedly having trouble keeping heading, altitude, and speed under control, despite the controller's best efforts to help bring him around to vector him in for the approach. And the long and short of it was, after 45 minutes or so of this, the pilot apparently just gave up, and according to witnesses, the airplane came out of the sky in a spiral condition straight down, and of course you know the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
When the NTSB reported looking at the pilot's logbook, discovered that he had obtained his instrument rating just less than a year, or just a little bit more than a year before the accident. And during that entire course of instruction, which minimally is 40 hours, he had logged a total of 4.8 hours of actual experience instrument in time. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
The rest was all simulated. And you just need to read the NTSB report. It's just shouting at the readers that this pilot simply became overwhelmed by the fact that he couldn't see out the windows. And that's why I say that pilots who have been trained or have received their instrument rating based upon even over 70% of their time in simulated conditions, they have the rating, but they certainly do not, in my opinion, have the skills to manage what's going to be facing them in the real environment. And I use kind of a hunting metaphor, suggesting that, for example, we might go bear hunting with a BB gun.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly gives us something to hold, and it looks like the proper equipment to go bear hunting with. But as anybody who's been out in the field would know, that's really kind of a joke, even attempting to do that. And therefore, I quite forcefully argue that if you're serious about flying on instruments in the real world, you need to train on instruments in the real world.
Well, and I have to point out here, we talked a couple of weeks ago, Bob, on one of these Monday sessions about your efforts to put together a Part 141 curriculum, which combines primary and instrument training as a simultaneous functions. And you mentioned at the time that that was actually the best time to get people used to that environment of, especially with a G1000 equipped Cessna 172, of getting them, accustomed to flying on instruments, early on in their training. I think, thinking back to my primary training for the private pilot certificate, we used foggles in the hood and that sort of thing. But I do remember you know, even if you're totally honest with yourself and don't try to sneak a look out from under the hood, you're aware of things going by, and there is at least the calming effect of knowing you could look out. You know, any kind of stressful environment will eventually wear you down if you're in it for long enough. You know, you might function fine in that environment for 3 or 4 minutes, even though your heart's racing and your palms are sweating. But man, if you're into it for 20 or 30 minutes, eventually you'll break down.
Well, yes, if you're intimidated by what's going on outside, you're very correct in that. I believe, you know, I'm a pilot that flew the first 12 years of his flying experience as a VFR pilot only.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went on to take instrument training, I was scared to death. I mean, I was actually intimidated by the thought of being in the clouds. Now, I didn't mind the hood. I that was easy. I could put on a view limiting device and show the instructor that I could follow, you know, heading and altitude. But the first time he took me into actual conditions, I know firsthand, I was in a panicky state. And anytime we're in a panicky state, our brain shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes tremendously ineffective. So if that first experience, or even second or third experience, and I'm talking about hard IFR, not IFR where, you know, we still have, we're between layers and we have we can't see the ground, but it's light IFR. But when you get into hard IFR where you can't see the wingtip, that can be a very, very confining, almost a claustrophobic kind of an environment to operate in. And as soon as we get a little behind the airplane, for example, the controller has us going one way and then he admonishes us for not going in a particular way. Now the workload is a little bit overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what happened in the pilot's accident that I related here. And I think it's all due to the fact that we're not getting into real IMC for the training. Now, as I say this, I have great compassion for flight schools that happen to be situated in Florida, Arizona, New Mexico. I know that they just do not have the opportunity to put their students into hard IFR. In Florida, when it's hard IFR, it's usually thunderstorms associated with it, and you can't go there anyway. So what do the students south of the Mason-Dixon line do for training? Well, they do the same thing I do in the east if I want to fly in the mountains. I don't train here, you know, hard mountain flying. I go to the Rocky Mountains or Alaska and get good, solid mountain flying experience from trained instructors out there. Same thing. If you want to fly ultimately in the real IFR environment, you can't get that training in the sunny, in much of the south, particularly the southwest. Come north.
Mm-hmm.
Go to Chicago for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Come to Buffalo. Go to Boston. Go to the West Coast. Go to Seattle.
I spent 10 years in Portland. That would have been great.
Yeah, that's where you learn how to fly on instruments. Now, you can, as I said, you can get the rating in New Mexico. But I heard one of my readers wrote in the other day, a couple of weeks ago, and he said, and I'll publish this in the next issue, he says, my instructor says, congratulations, you have your ticket, but don't think you can fly in the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was an admonishment to stay out of the clouds. And I thought, well, then why bother? Why bother getting the rating?
Bob, tell me a little bit about your instrument training. Did your instructor, it sounds like your instructor did get you in actual clouds.
Well, yeah, by just force of nature. When you train, and I did all my instrument training in the wintertime here in Buffalo in western New York, that's the only weather we have.
Yeah.
And I honestly cringe when I inherit a student or I do a check ride on it or a biennial flight review or an instrument proficiency check, and I look at the student is from Buffalo, and I look in their logbook and I see out of 70 hours of instrument training, 3 hours of actual and the rest is simulated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a view limiting device. That, you know, I said, where did you take this training in Arizona? Oh, no, I took it right here in Buffalo. My instructor didn't like to go in the clouds, so he just put me under the hood on clear days. I said, why?
Yeah.
He said, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I know why, because that's the way his instructor was trained.
Right.
Likely. You know, the instructor was told, oh, single-engine IFR, that's not a place to be. So we don't really do IFR training in IFR conditions. We just simulate them. So in the unlikely event that you find yourself in the clouds, Well, that's okay if it's an unlikely event, but if you're going to be a serious over-the-road pilot, flying to Antilles three states away in the east or along the Pacific coast, golly, you better have that kind of training.
Bob, when we come back after the break, I want to talk a little bit about overbanking, something that you identified as a persistent problem for pilots in the proficiency area, and we'll talk about that in a moment. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves and of BMFT Inc., Bob Miller Flight Training. Bob, in your May issue of Over the Airwaves, you identified overbanking as something that appears to be something private pilots are prone to, or unproficient pilots. What is the overbank, and what are you observing here?
Well, again, with flying, certainly you can expect this from students. They're not sure what kind of a bank angle they should be at, and that's the reason they're receiving instruction. But having done a fair number of flight reviews and flying with other pilots, I sit there and I just hang on when I see the airplane going on, banking over 30 degrees, and I ask myself, why are we doing this? In the instrument environment, it is even more insidious. I have an excellent instruments friend, a person I taught as a personal friend, and I do an instrument proficiency check with him in the clouds in solid IFR. And invariably, he finds himself over 30, 40, sometimes 45 degrees, not really realizing he's over that steep, mm-hmm. and I have to correct him immediately. And I ask him, why are we banking this steeply? And in that case, he just simply was not aware that the bank angle was so steep. And in the VFR environment, there really is no need for it. Ask any air traffic controller how fast a turn he expects when he issues a vector change or a heading change. And all he really needs is standard rate, 3 degrees per second. That's basically far less than the 30-degree bank. Now, here's the problem. Problem is, as we overbank, or as the airplane banks, the outside wing begins to travel faster than the inside wing on the turn. As it's traveling faster, it's developing more lift. So the higher the bank, the greater the tendency for the airplane to want to bank more. And that's how we get into an overbank situation. And there's really, again, aerodynamically, there's nothing really terribly wrong with an overbank as long as we're coordinated, as long as the airplane is moving through the sky in a coordinated, ball-centered attitude. Mm-hmm. But when it's not, we get ourselves into a yawed effect, a yawed bank. Should that be coupled with a stall, and then we have the surefire formula for a spin. Now, again, the hapless pilot says, well, my airplane doesn't stall until it gets down to 40 knots. Uh-huh. Well, what happens to the stall speed of an airplane in a 60-degree bank? In a 60-degree bank, the load factor is double. Mm-hmm. We know that the stall speed, and this gets a little bit involved, but it's not that terribly sophisticated, as the bank angle increases, the load factor doubles at 60 degrees, and we know that the stall speed increases in proportion to the square root of the load factor. Translated, an airplane that normally stalls at 40 knots in a 60-degree bank will stall at about 57 knots.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's move that up to an inadvertent 80 degree bank. The load factor goes to 4. The square root of 4 is 2. Take that 40 knot stall speed times 2. Now his bank, now his stall speed in an 80 degree bank is 80 knots.
And if he was on his base to final turn, he's probably below 80 knots.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens. And we suffer one fatal stall spin accident a week in the United States. All right, I would like to ask all of us, all of our listeners, to just question the rationale for ever having to bank an airplane more than 30 degrees, either in VFR conditions or IFR conditions. The only time that I think it's essential that an immediate bank or a hard bank turn would be to avoid an imminent collision with another aircraft. Other than that, I can't find an aeronautical reason why a bank more than 30 degrees is ever required, unless, say, due to poor planning, our downwind leg is too close to the runway, mm-hmm. thereby making the base leg extremely short, and thereby forcing us to go into a steep bank to bring the airplane around to align with the final approach course. Now, again, when that happens, the better solution would just be to continue on the upwind and come all the way around the pattern and try it again. But proper planning in the traffic pattern should prevent the need to do any kind of steep banking. And if we can keep those bank angles less than 30 degrees, the possibility of a stall spin accident is tremendously reduced.
Well, I was going to say, too, there things can happen if you're on a cross country and you're coming into a strange airport and maybe you gauge the wind wrong. It may not be just poor planning. It may just be, you know, things you couldn't know. But again, if it happens, I mean, if you're looking at having to be a carnival ride in order to get it around in time to line up with a runway, you've probably put more on your workload on final approach than you ought to have there anyway. Just go around and try it again.
That's exactly right. And the wind, and we know this, if the wind on our base turn is coming from our back, it's going to push us through the final approach course. And the common tendency is, all right, let's just horse it around and see if we can get it on. And in the worst case scenario, when we put too much left rudder in there on a left-hand turn and cause the airplane to go skidding around, that's, again, a surefire formula for disaster. Best we should, as you pointed out, just continue through the final approach course, enter the upwind, and come back around and try it again. But what we lose sight of the fact is a banking condition worsens by itself simply because of the aerodynamic effects on the airplane. The more bank we put in, the more bank the airplane wants to produce. So it creates almost a negative stability on mm-hmm. that on the static side, a negative static stability. Also, the bank increases, in summary, the load factor, and we know that when the load factor goes up, the stall speed goes up. So the whole thing just sort of is a domino effect that's created for every degree beyond 30 degrees we put that airplane in. We're just asking for trouble.
Well, I'm going to suggest to our listeners that they read the entire text of these articles we've talked about on Over the Airwaves at overtheairwaves.com. Bob, next Monday is going to be Memorial Day, so we're going to take the day off, but we'll look for you again in early June.
Thanks a lot, Paul. See you soon.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening, and have a clear and unlimited day.